remixing Jane Austen for a satire on modern divorce.
Where in Sense and Sensibility, the father, Mr. Dashwood, dies, and he has a wife and two daughters who get absolutely nothing from his estate, but his son from a previous marriage gets everything. I was thinking about that and why that felt so weirdly contemporary, and then I just realized that in our time, the place where money and love coincide is not so much in marriage or even in death, but in divorce.
That's novelist Kathleen Shine. We talk with her about her hilarious and poignant novel, The Three Weissmans of Westport. It's about how a mother and her two adult daughters survive divorce and disappointment to find a deeper bond with each other. And we also air an excerpt from our 2010 interview with climate scientist Dr. James Hansen. He was arrested on August 29th in front of the White House during the 10th day of protests against the proposed Keystone XL pipeline. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rianna. Novelist Kathleen Shine grew up in Westport, Connecticut. The town provides the main setting for her latest novel, The Weissmans of Westport. Inspired by Jane Austen's Sense and Sensibility, it's a wickedly funny satire on the modern conventions of divorce. It's also a poignant look at the bonds between adult daughters and their mothers, and at finding love in unexpected places. The main characters, 75-year-old Betty Weissman and her middle-aged daughters Annie and Miranda, find themselves together in a run-down cottage in Westport. That's because Betty has had to move out of the Central Park West apartment she shared with her husband of 50 years when he took up with a woman half his age. And her daughters are facing their own problems. So they all move in together and end up finding out surprising things about themselves and each other. Author Kathleen Shine takes the opportunity to skewer, among other things, male privilege, the book industry, and lurid memoirs. The Times reviewer wrote, "The Three Weissmans of Westport is richly inhabited. Shine's characters, minor and major, have such a precisely imagined presence that they need only nod with affectionate courtesy to the shadows cast by Sense and Sensibility before chasing them away." Kathleen Shine, The Three Weissmans of Westport. First of all, why don't you just tell us the broad outlines of the plot? What happens?
Well, one day, Joseph Weissman comes home. He's 78 years old, and he comes home to his wife, who's 75. They've been married for almost 50 years, and he says, "We have to get divorced. We have irreconcilable differences." And she says, "Irreconcilable differences? What does that have to do with divorce?" But it turns out his irreconcilable difference is named Felicity. And so this long marriage is now dissolving. And Betty, his wife, ends up moving from their beautiful apartment on Central Park West to a tiny rundown cottage on the beach in Westport, Connecticut. And her two daughters, who are both around 50, are having their own problems, and they decide they'll go there to be supportive for their mother. They do, and so it's a kind of reclaiming of the nuclear family. The three of them, minus the father, are together, and they all regress on the one hand and stuck in this tiny little cottage. And on the other hand, they all three kind of find different things along the way that broaden and open their lives up. And it's kind of an homage to Sense and Sensibility, and some of it is, out and out fast. But I was very influenced by that when I started writing it.
Yeah, so let's start there. Why Sense and Sensibility? I know in some of your other work you've also kind of taken on various literary influences. What drew you to Jane Austen? Why this vehicle to talk about some of the things that you go into very deeply in this book?
I was thinking about writing about older people in love because I find that very interesting, because unlike younger people in love, they have much longer histories that they're dragging around with them. Sometimes I think what my son, when he was little, he packed a pillowcase with oranges and went to the front door, and because he couldn't reach the door handle, but he said he was running away. But he had this bag, this lumpy bag of like oranges and his teddy bear in it. And I think that, you know, most of us at a certain age, we are dragging around these pillowcases with all our teddy bears and lumpy oranges and all of our histories with us. And if you meet someone else who has their own lumpy pillowcase full of history, it can be a very interesting and often comic encounter. So that was something I was interested in doing. And I hadn't quite figured out how. And then I was reading Sense and Sensibility again. And when I finished it, I got this funny feeling. I was thinking, why does it feel so modern among all the other wonderful things about it? And I just suddenly realized that in the 19th century, where marriage and money constantly met, because people of a certain class needed to marry for money because they weren't supposed to work, but they had to maintain their status as a gentleman or a gentlewoman. And where in Sense and Sensibility, the father, Mr. Dashwood, dies, and he has a wife and two daughters who get absolutely nothing from his estate, but his son from a previous marriage gets everything. And I was thinking about that and why that felt so weirdly contemporary. And then I just realized that in our time, the place where money and love coincide is not so much in marriage or even in death, but in divorce. And I thought of a lot of my mother's contemporaries in particular who had gotten married and in a generation where you really, not only weren't you supposed to work, you were supposed to not work, and were suddenly just set adrift when, at an advanced age, when their husband suddenly decided that they wanted something different. So it was kind of about the fragility of older women of a certain generation, and just of the fragility of all of us in the face of losing a lot of money. I wrote this right after the crash had happened, so I was very inspired, shall we say.
I think many women are in this situation, not just during a financial crisis, but almost any time. I mean, there's one point in the book where you say, let's see if I can find it, and this is actually not so much, well, you talk about the jettisoned wife, which I think is a very apt phrase to use, but also the way in which women, once they reach a certain age, you know, it could be 40, it could be 50, are now no longer seen as important. I know where it is. It's at a reading. One of the characters, I believe it's Annie, is at a reading, and she sees all these lively, intelligent women who are beautiful in their own way, middle-aged, you know, who nobody pays any attention to anymore.
Yeah, I think that at a certain point, you know, women can suddenly, at a certain age, seem irrelevant to the culture in general, and often to their husbands. Which is not to say it doesn't go the other way around, and that, you know, men don't have their own issues. But that wasn't what I was writing about. And I think it's true. I mean, I've seen it more in my mother's generation than my own, but certainly in my own also. In the generation coming after me, you know, the people I know who are younger, who are married, who are in their 30s, a lot of times now I'm seeing that it's the woman who has the real job, and it's the men who are actually in that more precarious position. It has to do with money and who's got the money and who's got the power. And it's very hard in a marriage for, you know, two people to be equal in that regard, if, you know, because you have children and just because of the way things work. But I'm not a sociologist. I just found this particular, this echo of something that Jane Austen was writing about. And for her, it was a completely different cause, but, you know, but there was the same kind of sense of, oh, we were in a certain position, now we've been thrown off a cliff, and we don't know how this happened. And how do you deal with that? What do you do? So that was a lot of what I wanted to explore in the book, and also just the humor and the the drama of a family, of grown daughters living in a house with their mother, which is always pretty interesting.
And we have to say, also I have to tell our listeners, first of all, that I'm talking with Kathleen Shine, novelist Kathleen Shine, about her latest novel, The Three Weissmans of Westport. And the humor in this novel is just marvelous, the wit of it, and the satire, the things that you skewer, everything from memoirs and the modern way of doing memoirs to divorce lawyers. And the younger daughter, Miranda, is a literary agent, and she gets her own upheaval, which throws her in with her sister and her mother. Tell us what happens to her.
Well, Miranda specializes in memoirs, and she's the kind of person who, if you were talking to her on the phone, she could draw out of you some, wild story that would make a fabulous memoir. She's a very passionate and successful literary agent who specializes in that kind of thing. But she has a kind of crash when it turns out that not one, not two, but three of her writers are not really what they seem, that their gigantic adventures are not true, and that actually they're these very ordinary people who have made up their histories. So, she has to go on Oprah and sort of try to explain that. But, I mean, it's a disaster for her and her career, because she is her career. That is her identity, is her career. And when that's suddenly taken away from her because nobody, trusts her anymore, and everyone wants to get as far away as possible, she's devastated. And it's partly no income, but it's partly no life.
And then she falls in love. This woman who's always put her career first, who's never been in love with anybody, really, she falls in love with not a very appropriate guy, but ultimately leads her to a different kind of love of this little child.
Yeah, as I was writing it, I wasn't planning that, but I put this little boy in, and the more I wrote about them, I found that she was really falling for this kid, and he's 2 years old, and I must say that although I never write about my children, because I think it's very unfair for parents to do that to their children, even though now my children are grown up, maybe it's even more unfair then, but as I wrote about this little boy, I was just overwhelmed with this tenderness of thinking about my own children when they were young. And so I kind of fell in love with this little boy, and so did Miranda. And so that's part of the book that I was not expecting at all, and that I'm very happy with. It was very moving for me to actually write it, because it made me think so much about my children when they were young.
Yeah, and we should tell our listeners, this little boy is the son of the man that Miranda falls in love with for a portion of the book. But talking about children and the tenderness with which you write about things, there's a wonderful passage on page 160, and I'm going to read it if you let me do this. I don't normally read things at length, but I'd like our listeners to just get a sense of this. So this is where one of Annie's sons has come home, Nick. He's come to where she's living with her mother. I'll just start out at the top of the page of 160. This is him talking, and maybe you can fill in if I miss something here. "I'm sorry you had to bounce from the apartment, Grandma." "Bounce," Betty said. "I like that. I bounced," she smiled. Nick looked around him at the little living room. "It's very," he paused, "it's very cozy here, that's for sure." The mood of the cottage had changed completely with Nick's arrival. The Costco fire cast a yellow glow on the small room. The tea Betty had poured was fragrant and hot. Nick's voice was young and loud as he laughed and told his traveler's tales and made them laugh with him. "You knew he was coming," Annie said suddenly to her mother. "You did, didn't you?" "She did," Nick said. "She planned the whole thing." "How could you keep it a secret, Mom?" "I have many secrets," Betty said. And Annie realized that she did, that her mother to whom she condescended, at whom she rolled her eyes, her mother whom she adored and admired, even as she felt the superiority of a younger generation toward her, this woman whom she thought she knew so well, had secrets, had an inner life Annie knew nothing about. And a little bit later on the page, she says to her son, "I remember you when you were a little boy," she said so softly, he almost didn't hear her. She stroked his hair thoughtfully. "Just a little, little boy." There were tears in her eyes. This is so poignant. You know, I read this with such a shock of recognition. And I love the way you put those generations together. What are you saying about family here?
Well, you know, my family is very close in terms of the generations. And I've spent summers at my mother's house. And, you know, there's the inevitable fight over how to load the dishwasher and a lot of, you know, female territorial stuff. But there's something so so wonderful about seeing this connection and seeing sometimes a connection between your child and your mother that you don't have and that you're kept out of to a certain extent. And I think it, for me anyway, and I think for Annie at this moment, it makes you, on the one hand, realize that your son is yours and your mother is yours, but on the other hand, that they don't belong to you at all, that they belong to themselves. And sometimes that's a shock for a, you know, sort of bossy daughter or mother. So, and to me, that's a kind of very tender moment when you recognize both those things at the same moment.
The book is The Three Weismans of Westport, and we're talking with the author, novelist Kathleen Shine. Your novel, in fact, your writing has been, you know, called by some people within the genre of what's called chick lit. And I really had a little bit of trouble with this because I was trying to think, you know, I think of chick lit as something that is superficial, that doesn't really go deeply into emotions, into feelings, into truth. You know, it's just kind of light. But then I began to think, well, is there something wrong with my definition of this? Is chick lit something that is putting down literature that women write about women?
Well, I think, you know, when it first started, I've been writing long enough so that my first novels came out when there was no such thing as chick lit. So that was never an issue. Nor did anyone say they were women's novels or anything like that. They were just novels, which is, you know, honestly, that's how I would prefer it. But chick lit sort of developed into this publishing phenomenon. I don't think it's as much a literary phenomenon as it is a publishing phenomenon, where publishers had this way to market certain kinds of books, and you put certain covers on them, and young women responded and bought them, and it was a marketing thing. And I don't know when the first one was, but it was maybe Bridget Jones or something like that. I'm not sure. And suddenly, I was seeing these pieces written in, you know, literary magazines saying the chick lit of Kathleen Shine, and then it would say, it's so odd because her chick lit doesn't fit in with all of the, you know, it doesn't have any of the marks of chick lit. So this is very interesting chick lit. And I thought, well, if it doesn't have any of the marks of chick lit, why is it chick lit? Well, because I'm a woman and I write about women. So that felt a little bit, you know, had that little ghetto sting to it. But then people started referring to Jane Austen as chick lit. And then I thought, well, this has gotten so broad, I'm happy to be in the, you know, if I can be in the same tent with Jane Austen in any way, I'll take it. But I think it's something that people are not going to be talking about in probably 5 years even. I think it was a marketing thing that's going to pass, and people will start talking about books as they are, I hope. But if not, I'll stand next to Jane Austen. Well, I'll kneel before Jane Austen in the tent.
Talking about women, well, let's talk about men for a moment here, because they're certainly not absent from this book. Everyone from Cousin Lou, who is a very benevolent figure, He is, in fact, the benefactor, the financial benefactor, who makes it possible for Betty and her daughters to survive their exile in the wilderness there. But Joseph Weissman, he's very wonderfully drawn, I think. His daughters love him, but they take their mother's part. He's not a bad man, really. Is he just self-indulgent?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think he's going through something, and he's, you know, and also he's fallen in love, which is very, very inconvenient for the rest of his family. You know, I think, yes, he's obviously, the self-indulgent part is the part where he won't admit that this is, you know, something that is really difficult for everybody else, and kind of feels that it's his due. As people in love often do, they forget what's going on around them and think, well, this is wonderful. Why isn't everybody happy for me? You know, and he also, I think, has the faults of many people, that when suddenly it comes to money, it seems everything does seem to belong to oneself. You can't really understand why you would be sharing it with this person you've shared your life with. I think these are very common flaws and characteristics that all men and women have. But I think because of his age, and because it's a divorce, and because of his generation, it's much more, you see that kind of thing, or saw it much more in men than in women. And I find it interesting. I mean, I like flawed people. They interest me. I'm interested in people who can sort of justify everything they do, no matter how awful or painful it is for other people. So that was something. He's not a completely bad person, but he is a person with a lot of imperfections, shall we say. But I liked him. I mean, I felt with the other characters that he was behaving very, very badly, but people do. Which is not to excuse him, but just to, for me, it made it more, you know, it made him an interesting character.
Right. Are you working on anything else now?
I am. This book has sort of kept me doing things on the road more than I expected, so I'm not nearly as far into it as I had hoped, but I am writing another book. It's about an 11-year-old boy starts in 1964, who loses both his parents and is brought up by a much, much older sister in Greenwich Village in 1964.
Wow, that sounds really interesting. I'd love to talk with you again when it comes out.
Thank you. I would love to have it come out to finish it.
I understand. I haven't read other novels of yours before this one. In fact, this introduces me to your work, and I'm very pleased that it does. Kathleen Shine, some of your other books, as I did a little bit of research on the internet, you've been influenced by other authors, just as in this one, influenced by Jane Austen. What does this do for you to kind of use other authors as your muse, perhaps?
Well, it's a kind of, for me, it's a great pleasure. I love to write. I'm not a white-knuckled writer who, you know, is clinging to the table, freaking out like Kafka. I love it. It's the best thing in the whole world to be doing once I get down to it and stop procrastinating, which I'm very, very good at also. But there's something about, not every book has had, there were a couple books that really had other texts within them. So in Rameau's Niece, I wrote an 18th century pornographic philosophical text that I put into the book, and that was great fun. And I used to write parodies, so, you know, there's something about this engagement with someone else's work that's for me very stimulating. But it follows whatever my interest is at that moment. It's a way to be even more interested in it, and of course I forget whatever it is I've learned the minute the book is finished. So I used to know a lot about biology, evolution, and the Galapagos Islands, and Darwin, and then I finished writing The Evolution of Jane. Of course, I can't remember thing about it. So, but for me, I think it's just that it adds a kind of richness to the experience of writing, and it's another way in to understand people and understand what it is they do and what it is they might have done in the 19th century novels that I love. It's very different from, you know, from what they would do now, and it's very much the same. So it's that idea, I think, that makes this keep happening. In The New Yorkers, which is a book about just a little street, one block in New York City, and people and their dogs, I was very much influenced by Trollope, but you wouldn't necessarily notice it in the book. But I was reading a lot of Trollope and trying to really understand about writing about a lot of different characters in one place and the kind of issues that come up among them, and it was very instructive, and of course it was also just an excuse to read Trollope for a year or so.
Do you think you'd ever do something influenced by Kafka?
No, I did a little parody of, it was when Ivana Trump was doing something, I can't remember. She was writing a novel, maybe. I can't remember, but I did a little Kafka parody a long time ago for the New York Times. But no, I mean, Kafka's great, but it's not a sensibility that I'm, at the moment anyway, interested in exploring. It's one that I have been very interested in reading, but not one that I really want to, you know, throw myself into. But you never know.
So
yeah, no, I get a lot of pleasure out of reading, and I get a lot of pleasure out of writing. And Barbara Pym said something once in a letter about one of her early novels that she was working on, and she was describing it, and she said, "So it should give some people some comfort." And I thought, that's a very worthy goal that people don't really think about anymore in writing. It's kind of unfashionable to think, it's kind of, you know, middle brow to think, oh, I'll get comfort from a book. But, you know, when I was writing The New Yorker, it was right after 9/11, and I got a lot of comfort out of it, and I wanted to make it a book that would provide some kind of comfort to readers. So Kafka doesn't provide much comfort. He provides insight, but not much comfort.
Cold comfort.
Yeah, cold comfort is right.
Well, this book, The Three Weismans of Westport, I found was immensely satisfying to read. And I want to thank you so much, Kathleen Shine, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about it. And I really look forward to reading your next one.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Thank you.
Kathleen Shine is the author of The Three Weismans of Westport. She's written numerous other novels, including The New Yorkers, The Love Letter, The Evolution of Jane, Ramo's Niece, and To the Birdhouse. Next up, Hurricane Irene brings the climate crisis urgently to mind. We'll hear excerpts from an interview I did with climatologist James Hansen about his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. It aired originally in 2010. Hansen was just arrested for protesting a proposed pipeline from the tar sands of Alberta down to the Gulf of Mexico. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. On August 29th, right after Hurricane Irene rampaged up the East Coast, 70-year-old climate scientist James Hansen was arrested in front of the White House. He was taking part in a protest against a Canadian company's proposal to construct a $7 billion, 1,700-mile pipeline. The Keystone XL pipeline would pump a particularly dirty type of heavy crude oil from the tar sands of Alberta, Canada, all the way to refineries along the U.S. Gulf Coast. The protests are organized by the group Tar Sands Action, spearheaded by environmental writer and advocate Bill McKibben. He's been a guest on this show several times, and like Hansen, he was arrested at the protest. I thought it would be a good time to revisit my conversation with James Hansen. He came onto Writer's Voice in February of 2010 to talk about his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. I asked James Hansen if he thought that the target set at Copenhagen for a limit in the rise of global temperatures of 2 degrees Celsius was adequate.
Well, we know that that's a disaster scenario. So far, we've had a rise in temperature of 8/10 of 1 degree Celsius, and we already see that the ice sheets on Greenland and Antarctica are not going to be stable on the long run. The rate at which Greenland is losing ice accelerated from 150 cubic kilometers several years ago to 300 cubic kilometers per year now, and likewise Antarctic rate of ice loss has accelerated. 2 degree warming would mean that those ice sheets are unstable and we will get sea level rise of several meters, which would have disastrous consequences. And we would also lose all the mountain glaciers around the world, which provide fresh water for actually billions of people from the rivers that originate in the mountains. And the expansion of the subtropics, which we can already see is affecting the southwest United States and causing the lakes to run dry and forest fires to increase. The stress we're putting on coral reefs, for example, the Arctic sea ice would all be gone with the effects that would have on wildlife there and indigenous peoples. So we really, what we've learned in the last few years is that to stabilize climate at a level that allows the species that we now have on the planet to continue to exist is going to require that we stabilize carbon dioxide at a level of no more than 350 parts per million. And that would be possible if we phase out coal use over the next few decades and if we prohibit unconventional fossil fuels. But in fact, what we see is that governments are allowing continued expansion of coal use and even beginning to use these unconventional fossil fuels like tar sands.
One thing that seems striking to me is that there's an awful lot of talk about how climate change is going to affect those people over there. It'll affect Africa. It will affect Bangladesh. And of course, those are terrible things, but there seems to be an assumption that it's not going to be affecting us here at home. What kind of sea level rise are we likely to see here in the U.S., especially on the East Coast?
That depends on what time scale we refer to, but that's why I'm concerned particularly about my children and grandchildren, because we can see very well what is going to happen as warming continues and as the ice sheets become more and more unstable. Because what happens is as the rate of discharge of these icebergs to the ocean increases, we will reach a level at which they begin to cool the North Atlantic and the Southern Ocean around Antarctica. And as the low latitudes continue to get warmer, this increased temperature gradient from the low latitudes to the high latitudes will drive stronger frontal or cyclonic storms, which in extreme cases generate winds comparable to that in hurricanes. When you combine these stronger storms with the rising sea level, we're going to get disasters at coastal cities all along the United States coast and other coastlines, which because of the populations. I mean, we had a disaster at New Orleans, but that's a relatively small city. Once we start to have storms with storm tides and increasing sea level on large cities, we're going to have social and economic disasters associated with that, which will make New Orleans look like a small thing in comparison.
Yes, I was reading, now this was a two-year-old report, but I was reading a report about preparedness, hurricane preparedness in New York. Somebody there said, if you're not wealthy and you don't have a car, basically you won't be able to get out of the city.
Yeah, and it doesn't, you see, the thing is, it won't require a hurricane. Once you get a nor'easter with rising sea level and with increasing strength in these mid-latitude frontal storms, then you can get a comparable response without an actual hurricane.
Well, you talk about the loading the dice as a metaphor. What is the relationship between that and the frequency of these storms?
Well, I used the dice to illustrate the fact that although natural fluctuations are as yet still larger than the mean rise in temperature, but the perceptive person can notice that the frequency of unusually warm seasons is already beginning to increase. The dice are loaded. The same applies to extremes of the hydrologic cycle. By that I mean on the one extreme, heavy rainfalls and floods, and on the other extreme, heat waves and droughts. Because as the world gets warmer, the atmosphere can hold more water vapor. That means that when you do have rainfall, you can get heavier rainfall and bigger floods. But at the times and places when it's dry, because of the increased temperature, you get greater drying and higher temperatures. And we can see that the dice are already beginning to be loaded. For example, where I live, we've had two so-called 100-year floods in the last 15 years. And that's the kind of loading of the dice that is going to occur as we continue to push the climate to the more extreme global warming.
You give really what you say is a short course in climatology. We don't have time to go into the kind of detail that you did in the book, which is fascinating. But can you give us some of the highlights of that so that we can understand what are some of the issues here and be able to be more intelligent when people who deny that there's climate change come back with their arguments?
What I've tried to do is, in each chapter, include a modest amount of science, including, in some cases, one or two graphs, just to show what is happening. And I also point out that I am going to include these graphs and some others that help people understand climate change on my Columbia University website. So I do think you're right that we have to try to get the public to understand what is happening and see that things are changing along the direction that is expected. Because the fundamental thing about climate is the inertia of the system, which is easy to understand because the ocean is 4 kilometers, about 2.5 miles deep. The ice sheets are a couple of miles thick. These things do not change immediately as you begin to apply a forcing to them. And by a forcing, I mean something that alters the planet's energy balance. So, for example, if we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, that reduces the heat radiation that the planet is emitting to space because it's like a blanket on the Earth. So it keeps the heat more effectively at the Earth's surface. And that radiation imbalance then causes the ocean to begin to get warmer. as the ocean gets warmer, it melts the ice shelves, which are the tongues of ice that come out from the Antarctic and Greenland ice sheet into the ocean. As the ice sheets begin to melt, that allows the ice streams, the more plastic part of the ice sheets, to begin to discharge their icebergs to the ocean more rapidly. And so this all takes time because the ocean, you know, just as your swimming pool doesn't warm up immediately when the sun comes up, it takes a time to absorb the energy and get warmer. But we see this happening. We see the deep ocean getting warmer. We see the ice streams beginning to move faster. They're discharging icebergs more than twice as fast as they were just 10 years ago. So that's the nature. That's why the problem is an intergenerational issue. We are the ones adding the gases to the atmosphere that cause these processes to get started. But it's our children and grandchildren who will bear the brunt of the problem. And that's why it's an issue of intergenerational inequity. It's one that we didn't understand when our parents were beginning this fossil, the heavy fossil fuel use. They didn't realize that they were going to cause problems for future generations. But now the picture has become clear. We realize that we are causing problems for our children and grandchildren if we don't get on a different path. And that's why we have to begin to address it now. The truth is, the things that we need to do make sense for other reasons. Why should we continue to go after the last drops of oil on the earth and exploit these really dirty, unconventional fossil fuels when they wouldn't last indefinitely anyhow? We're going to need to move on to cleaner energies. So why not do it now and preserve a planet and allow the other species to continue to exist, rather than trying to get the last drop of these fossil fuels?
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with climate scientist Dr. James Hansen. His book is Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. When you say that this takes a long time to unfold, you also point in the book that it's taking an awful lot shorter time than other climate change events in the Earth's history. Because, of course, a lot of the climate deniers say, well, Earth has warmed up before, and it's been just peachy, literally peachy. We can have peaches in New England, which actually we're already beginning to be able to grow here and to have. So explain about these timelines that you say in the book, we're doing this about 10,000 times more powerful. The human changes are 10,000 times more powerful than natural climate forcings. So if this is a long time, how come it's so short?
Yeah, well, it's certainly true. There have been huge climate changes in the Earth's history. If we go back 50 million years, there was no ice on the planet. It was much warmer. Sea level was 75 meters, about almost 250 feet higher than it is now. And, of course, that if you got to that situation, it would be pretty stable. But to get there from here would, of course, flood billions of people out of their homes. And we have lived in a climate, the Holocene, the last 10,000 years, in which the climate has been relatively stable with sea level at the level it is now. And, yeah, the rate at which we are changing carbon dioxide is about 10,000 times faster than the natural rates of increase or decrease that gave rise to these very large but slow changes of the climate during the Earth's history. And, of course, if we civilization developed with the climate that we've had during the last 10,000 years, and unless we want enormous disruptions to civilization, we need to keep the climate roughly within that range that has existed during the last 10,000 years.
Hansen says that we do have some time to turn things around, but to do that, we'll have to get off coal, and fast. You say we need to keep all the coal in the ground, and
yeah,
we need a transition
yeah.
period to get rid, you know, to stop using oil and gas.
Yeah, well, the reason is, first of all, there's more coal. There's more carbon in coal than there is in oil and gas. And the oil and gas are very convenient fuels, which are limited in amount. We've used about half of the oil that we know about. And it's very difficult to see how we could prevent the use of the readily available oil and gas. It's owned by countries like Russia and Saudi Arabia. But coal is not only has the most carbon dioxide, but it's also the dirtiest fuel. It's the one that we could decide to leave in the ground or to use it only at power plants where we capture the CO2 and put it back in the ground. But it just doesn't look like that's economically or practically workable. So it's clear, unless you're going to tell, you know, I met with the environment minister of Germany after I'd written a letter to the chancellor, and they agreed that we would have to limit the CO2 emissions and try to get CO2 back below 350 parts per million. But at the same time, they're planning to build more coal plants. And my question then was, well, then how are you going to convince Russia to leave its oil in the ground, its gas in the ground, and how to convince Saudi Arabia to leave its oil in the ground? And, of course, there is no prospect for doing that. So the only practical way to keep CO2 at a level that allows our climate to stay close to what it is now is to phase out coal use. And that's the dirtiest fossil fuel. It's the cause of a lot of problems. The mercury that makes it impractical for us to eat many of the fish that are now caught in the ocean. And the arsenic, asthma problems, there are many health problems associated with the coal. So it simply doesn't make sense to continue to rely on that. Since it's a finite resource anyway, we need to move on to the era beyond fossil fuels.
The percentage of Americans who think global warming is real and caused by human activity is actually going down, thanks to a relentless political campaign of denial bankrolled by the fossil fuel industry. How to communicate science to a disbelieving public is a problem James Hansen wrestles with in his book, Storms of My Grandchildren.
Well, I think the scientific community is becoming more concerned that we do have to communicate better. It used to be frowned upon if scientists tried to communicate. I remember when Carl Sagan began speaking to the public about planetary research that he found it harder, you know, to get along in the scientific community when he did that. But I think that attitudes are changing. Scientists realize that we have to do a better job of communicating, or the decisions made by the political process are not going to be optimum, but it's difficult, and I don't have any really good answer except, as I say, I try to introduce a little of the science and the scientific method in each chapter, and I intend to keep updating the science on these topics on my Columbia University website, hoping this is one way to get people to understand how the scientific method works.
My final questions have to do with the politics. You were the guy who actually explained climate change to Al Gore, but you write that the Clinton-Gore administration, you say that they were ineffectual in this matter, and you're being polite, that emissions substantially increased. What do you think happened? I mean, Gore understood this. Obama seems to also understand. And yet, the talk is greater than the action here. Why?
Well, I think it's largely because of the fact that in Washington, as well as other capitals around the world, money talks, and the fossil fuel industry's got a lot of money. I'm encouraged by the fact that Al Gore, in the Copenhagen discussions, he did clearly state, I believe for the first time, made a clear statement in public that it made more sense to put a price on carbon emissions and to use that money to return it to the public one way or another, either as a payroll tax deduction or as a dividend, as I suggest. The reason I prefer a dividend is we can then very easily see that it equals the amount that was taken in from the fee on carbon. And also half the people are not on payrolls. They're either retired or they're involuntarily out of work. But in any case, he made this clear statement, and also John Kerry made a statement that indicated he was open-minded about that, that didn't necessarily have to be a cap-and-trade with offsets scheme. So the politics is difficult because in our democracies, it's no longer strictly a case of one person, one vote. In many cases, it's $1, one vote.
Right.
Unless we can get campaign finance reform so that we can get money out of politics, it is going to be difficult.
You're hearing an interview I originally aired with climatologist James Hansen in February of 2010 about his book, Storms of My Grandchildren. He was arrested in front of the White House this August 29th when he took part in a protest against a proposed pipeline to bring crude oil from the tar sands of Canada down to the U.S. Gulf Coast. What do you think about the EPA regulating carbon dioxide? Do you think that that's an end run around the politics? Do you think that's going to work?
Well, it obviously is an end run, and on the short term, it can work and get us moving in the right direction. But it's not the best approach on the long run, because if we get an election and a different administration comes in, they may direct EPA in a different way. So we really need to make the fundamental changes. And as I keep repeating, but the only way to do that is to make the price of fossil fuels gradually rise so that the competition, the clean energies, and the energy efficiency can compete and take over for the fossil fuels, and we move on to a cleaner future for our children and grandchildren.
What would you say now to listeners? You know, I mean, this is the point at which I guess listeners get told that they should call their congressperson, but given that Congress, as you say, you know, is listening more to the dollar votes than the ballot votes, what do you think citizens should do?
Well, I think that next spring is the key time, because now there is this reassessment of what the international response is going to be, because nothing was decided in Copenhagen. But it was actually useful that China and the U.S. did talk together and even signed the final agreed on this final accord, which doesn't have any clear actions in it, but it is going to depend now. The United States is going to have to decide where it is going, and I think if we can have an honest, open discussion about cap and trade with offsets versus an honest price with the funds distributed to the public, I think the public will be able to understand that if we're going to get off fossil fuels, we've got to put a rising price on that. And if the funds that are generated are distributed to the public, they'll go along with that. This is actually a trial of this has occurred in British Columbia, which is working very well. So we need to try it in the United States, I think.
Is this kind of the equal and opposite thing that happens in Alaska, where everybody gets a fossil fuel dividend?
Well, yeah, that dividend came from selling oil, but the dividend I'm talking about would come from taxing the oil and gas and coal at the mine, and that money then being distributed to the public.
So we need to come up with some kind of slogan that can say that well.
Well, the slogan I suggested was 100% dividend or fight. Because Congress, what they want to do, whenever there's a money source, they like to give it to their favorites or to invest it. They like to make decisions about investments like clean coal. That's the marketplace should make the decisions as to what technologies are going to win. If you put a rising price on carbon, then all the competitors will try to give you a lower price. And put the money in the hands of the public and let them invest it where they think is most effective, rather than where Congress wants to put it.
Well, Jim Hansen, storms of my grandchildren, the truth about the coming climate catastrophe, and our last chance to save humanity. That's the book. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice. There is nothing more important, I think, for us to think about, talk about, and act about.
Well, thanks very much for having me on.
Dr. James Hansen is the head of NASA's Goddard Institute for Space Studies. You can find a link to the group Tar Sands Action at writersvoice.net, as well as a link to the full interview I did with Jim Hansen in 2010. And here's a poem that's apropos of what we've been talking about today. It's Advice to a Prophet by Richard Wilbur.
Advice to a Prophet. When you come, as you soon must, to the streets of our city, mad-eyed from stating the obvious, not proclaiming our fall, but begging us in God's name to have self-pity, spare us all word of the weapons, their force and range, the long numbers that rocket the mind. Our slow, unreckoning hearts will be left behind, unable to fear what is too strange. Nor shall you scare us with talk of the death of the race. How should we dream of this place without us? The sun, mere fire, the leaves untroubled about us, a stone look on the stone's face. Speak of the world's own change. Though we cannot conceive of an undreamt thing, we know to our cost how the dreamt cloud crumbles, the vines are blackened by frost, how the view alters. We could believe, if you told us so, that the white-tailed deer will slip into perfect shade, grown perfectly shy, the lark avoid the reaches of our eye, the jack-pine lose its knuckled grip on the cold ledge, and every torrent burn as Xanthus once, its gliding trout stunned in a twinkling. What should we be without the dolphin's ark, the dove's return, these things in which we have seen ourselves and spoken? Ask us, prophet, how we shall call our natures forth, when that live tongue is all dispelled, that glass obscured or broken, in which we have said the rose of our love and the clean horse of our courage, in which beheld the singing locust of the soul unshelled, and all we mean or wish to mean. Ask us whether with the wordless rose our hearts shall fail us. Come demanding whether there shall be lofty or long standing, when the bronze annals of the oak tree close.
Richard Wilbur reading Advice to a Prophet. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.